Okay, move out.
You're listening to the Valor Podcast with Nick Lehman, a show highlighting the people who defend the United States of America and those who support them.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I was researching warfare the other day and how it has evolved over the years, but one thing that has stayed constant is, one, the men and women that are contributing to the cause, and two, the dogs being used in war. The Romans used them as base guards on patrols. Another fun fact is war dogs were used as breeding stock between European royalty and were seen as suitable tokens for exchange throughout the Middle Ages. But we'll have more on that in a little bit. Probably wondering why we're throwing dog facts there. But I would like to thank our show sponsor. They're the Comfort Inn and Suites in Gallup, New Mexico, for sponsoring the show. They're one of our first supporters and have been a tremendous support over the long time of the Valor Podcast. So if you're traveling across New Mexico and find yourself seeing Gallup on I-40, stop at the Comfort Inn Suites and stay there. They're veteran and military friendly. They have a lobby that I can tell you that has all kinds of relics from Civil War all the way to the current global war on terror. So tell Ken that I sent you. If you're a veteran or your family has served, tell them that they have served, and he'll take good care of you. So one of the most useful tools on the battlefield is the canine. They're highly trained, just like their handlers. Dogs have been used through the U.S. military as key members of the team. They're used for bomb sniffing, to guard beaches against the enemies, messengers, tunnel, and scout and patrol. The breeds are used are Belgian Malinois, German Shepherds, and Labs. We are joined by retired Navy SEAL Jimmy Hatch, who founded the nonprofit Spike's Canine Fund. As a canine handler on several deployments, James' life was regularly spared by the working of canines. One of the most memorable ones was Spike. So, thanks for joining me, Jimmy. It's an honor to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Nick. It's cool. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, thanks for serving our country and what you're doing now. Tell me a little bit about the Spike's Canine Fund and how you got it started.
Man, I just totally stumbled into it. I'll backtrack. I got wounded in 2009, and I did not suffer it well. So, I was wounded. A dog named Remco saved my life. Took two rounds from an AK right in front of me, about 15, 20 feet in front of me. But he let us know that they were there. And anyway, I got shot in the leg shortly thereafter. Went through a bunch of surgeries. I think I had 18 surgeries on my leg, and then I went through a lot of mental problems and emotional problems. So that was about a 2-year process. I retired in 2011. Tried to find some work. You know, I really struggled after. I wasn't able to really figure out who I was, and I didn't really have a good grasp on how to deal with, you know, the culture that it is outside of, you know, my little group of people that I was close to. So I tried a couple of different jobs and just didn't work out. And then one day I was, let me back up. I was kind of what you would call suicidal. And the night that I was suicidal, my wife called my former unit and said, "Hey man, you know, he's got guns in his mouth. I've taken them away from him. I was high on meds and drinking." And they said, "Look, man, you need to call the cops because, you know, we're not going to be able to get there quick enough." So these two police officers came to my house and they totally de-escalated the situation and calmed me down. And so there's the dogs I talked about, and then there's the cops. And so I kind of owe them. So I went over to fast forward again. I went over to the local, the same city police that were kind to me and de-escalated me and got me sent to the hospital where I could get the help I needed. And I asked their canine guys if they needed any help, and they said, "Yeah, sure." So I could wear a decoy suit for them or take pictures. I like to take pictures. So while I was there, one of the dogs, a dog who had done some pretty good things on the street here locally, caught some bad, you know, armed robbery suspects, things like that. He needed a surgery, and the surgery was, I guess you could call it experimental. So that, you know, the city has to be a good fiduciary, responsible person for, I mean, the city has to be a responsible party when it comes to spending the taxpayer dollars. So at some point, the veterinarian that represented the city and a few others decided that they didn't want to spend the money on the surgery for the dog. So the officer was a little bit, I guess despondent might be the right word. He was really bummed out, because when you have a dog that you work well with and that has succeeded on the street, that's a very good thing. And he didn't want to lose his partner. So I took a picture of me and Spike, and I got on Photoshop and got help from a buddy of mine, and we created a logo, and it's that logo that we still use for Spike's Canine Fund. And I had a bunch of sweatshirts printed up with a booster campaign, put them on social media, and I sold enough of them that I could pay for the surgery, pay for the officer to drive down to North Carolina. I live in Virginia, and get the surgery done, and the dog got fixed up. So it made me feel good. I had a lot of extra money left over, and I thought, man, I see a niche. So I stumbled into it, man, and then I found that there's a big need, and I feel really good because it's my mission now, and I needed a mission, you know?
Oh, yeah. One of the things I talk about on the Valor podcast is that everybody needs a mission, you know, whether it's a civilian life or even a veteran life, even in the military life. And I know that was a dark place for you where you were because of your injuries and you know, kind of being removed from being going across the world and doing some amazing things, protecting our country. And, you know, I love the special operator community and even the enlisted men and women, because they are protecting my right to put my kids to bed at night. I can read my books to them, and I have no problem doing that. I don't have a occupying force. So I can see the passion that you did with it, because I saw it start up and went with that case, and I was like, man, that's a really cool idea. I'm glad he is applying it to it. And then hearing the backstory of it, it's almost like you're saying thanks, and I got your back, because I got one, I'm a dog handler and I know a lot about it, and two, you helped me live, so to speak.
Yeah, man, for sure. No, they've definitely, and this is, you know, I'm almost 50 years old, and in my life, this seems to me to be the toughest time I can remember for there to be a police officer. Like it's rough, man. So helping those guys out makes me feel good. And helping those dogs, of course, you know, and truthfully, I owe both of them. And so, you know, the reason I'm still walking is because of the dogs, and honestly, because of those officers, those two cops that came over my house and chilled me out and let me get the help I needed. So yeah, man, you're right. I'm definitely paying them back.
And the nonprofit's named after Spike. And
yep.
Tell me a little bit about Spike. I mean, I'm a dog guy, so I recently just lost one of my favorite dogs that, you know, I trained him from when he was a pup, and it was a, you know, kind of a bad deal. But, you get attached to a dog, and people are like, it's just a dog. And I'm like, no, man, that's man's best friend. That's the guy that's guy going to help you out in tough spots, even if it's a civilian dog.
Yeah. I've always been a dog lover. When I went through Bud's, there was an instructor there who had, it was a funny story, man. He was a Vietnam guy, and he was a SEAL, and he was a dog handler in Vietnam. And then came home, stayed in the teams for a little while, got out and was a postman, like, you know, worked for the postal service. And then I guess he decided to come back in. And, anyway, they made him a Buds instructor, because during the time that I was in Buds, you know, they're the only people who had any kind of sustained combat with the Vietnam guys. Right. So, I got to chatting with him, and he was my favorite instructor by far. And I learned a lot from him, just watching how patient he was and watching him, work with us. And there's a portion of the training out on San Clemente Island, and there's these little foxes that are kind of, it's the only place I've ever seen them is out there. And they're, you know, they're scared of humans with good reason, but he could get them to eat out of his hand. It was really cool to watch him do it. And so anyway, he talked about the dogs a little bit and how it was a tough environment in Vietnam because of the heat and the humidity. And, but he said that the dogs had helped him and saved their ass. So, fast forward a few years, I was at my unit and, I wrote a paper saying, hey, you know, we need dogs. And they're like, yeah, okay, buddy. And they put it in a drawer somewhere. A few years later, 9/11 happens, and some of the other special operations units had stood up some dog units and they were helping them out. And, So our unit did that. We had a guy, a master chief at my unit, who did it. And I had volunteered. They said, hey, are you still interested in this dog thing? I said, yeah, man. So they went to Holland. We couldn't get the dogs that we wanted from, from the regular military dogs breeding program. So we went to Holland and got some dogs, and one of them was Spike. And, man, I like dogs, but honestly, I was never trained in how to actually work with them. So they were going to have to train me and him to work with me at the same time. So I started it off good, man. I went and bought some Slim Jims that day that I was going to meet him. And I took him in with me.
Hearts and minds.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And he was a pretty badass dog. And he was what people jokingly, the guys who knew what was going on, they call him Push Button, because he'd been trained so well. He was trained in a discipline called KNPV, Kilo November Papa Victor. And it's a Dutch police certification trial. It's a sport, but it's super difficult. And so he had a lot of good qualifications already. So he'd been trained to do a lot of things. And all I needed to do was learn some Dutch and to bond with him. And the truth is, I wasn't really a very good dog handler. And the reason I was not, by the standards of judgment, is that I don't believe that dogs are not like a gun, like a rifle. You come back, you put it up in the rack, you lock it up, and you go home, and you forget about it until you need to use it the next time. I wasn't like that. I was way too attached, very emotionally attached to him. I wanted that dog to love me, and I wanted him to know that I'd do anything for him, So that caused me some problems. I put my dog ahead of people sometimes, but I knew that they were going to be what's called a force multiplier. I knew that they would provide us with the opportunity to find bad guys before they found us, and to find explosives before they blew us up. So I really enjoyed it, and I really was very lucky with Spike, because, like I said, he'd been trained really well, and they kind of had to teach me how to read a dog. And that was a really interesting process, trying to figure out when they were alerted and, their body language and all that kind of stuff. And man, it's funny. I look at now, I have a similar dog to Spike, and she's out looking for the tennis ball, the way her tail's moving. I'm like, the way that tail's moving right there, I'll save your life, So it was cool, man. I really, that dog carried me for sure. He was a lot smarter than I ever gave him credit for. And then he was killed in Iraq in 2006 in what's called a shoot through. He was biting a guy, and I started putting rounds into the guy. And then one of the rounds went through him and killed him. And that, man, it tore me up. I didn't really feel the full weight of that until I got injured, and I'm laying there in the, 3 years later, and I'm laying there in the hospital room looking at the ceiling with all the bad things I did coming through my head. I wasn't thinking about any of the positives. So Spike has the kind of drive that I want to emulate. I don't have it, but I sure aspire to. He was an unbelievably driven dog, and he set a good example.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, when you have a dog in combat or in the deploy zone, I mean, there's those downtime. And I always, with dogs, sometimes I add, like, what are they thinking or what are they doing? What would you think Spike would be thinking at, like, the downtimes when you guys were just talking about, who's going to win the Super Bowl or who was going to do that? I know there's those levity moments, I think those dogs are always, like you said, push button, you push it on, and it's like he's ready to go to work in a snap.
Yeah. Well, Spike was, and most work dogs, people want you to be intimidated by them, because sometimes, especially guys, it's the same way with guns, right? Sometimes the gun or the dog is an extension of their insecurities. And I could make another joke, but we both know what I'm talking about, right? So maybe I was that way a little bit. I'm sure I was, but.
The 50 caliber Barrett sniper rifle. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Or my jacked up Ford 350, whatever, whatever. It all works itself out. But, Spike was the kind of dog too that, and truthfully, I believe all dogs are this way. Some dogs are better at it than others, obviously, but dogs can read people really well. They've been bred over the years, to respond to commands or, do certain tasks. And what they're really, really good at is reading they're the person that takes care of them, and in this case, the handler. So once we got deployed and we got a little bit of the kinks worked out where we were communicating well, he knew. I mean, I wouldn't let him run around our little camp, you know, on his own for sure, because he could hurt somebody if he wanted to. But he would go with me. We'd sit and have coffee, you know, and we had these little beat up couches, and we'd sit with, you know, and he knew the guys. They were his crew. So, you know, I always said, I'm like his dad, and you guys are his uncle. And they had to learn the commands, and he could work with any of them, which was good. You know, on some of the target sets we were on, it was good to have a dog that, you know, I could send him to a house and guys could direct him, you know, hey, this way. And it worked really well. But the downtime to him, I think, honestly, it didn't matter. I mean, it was cool to see him just be a dog, you know. But I think to him, he was always switched on in the sense that he was watching and listening to and feeling what everybody around him was feeling. And he was cool, man. He would sit on the couch with us, like, you know, like he was somebody's pet. And then we'd go out at night and he'd tear people up, you know, if he needed to. And one of the things that was cool about Spike too that I really liked, and a lot of the dogs from the KMPV world are this way, is that he could differentiate between military age males and females and children. And there were times where he could have hurt kids, or he could have hurt, you know, people that didn't have it coming, and he didn't. And I always felt like, man, that dog's smarter than I am. He was good to go.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to go back to something you touched on a little bit about the Vietnam War. The thing was back there is that, you know, they euthanized the dogs. They didn't bring them back to the stateside and all that. And, you know, back in like the mid 2000s and like 2010, there was like the social justice, social media cause. It was like, oh, we got to adopt all these military dogs and we got to adopt. And I just started laughing, and somebody asked me, well, why are you laughing, Nick? And I said, you're basically buying a Lamborghini for a dog and you don't know how to drive it.
Yeah.
Talk about how that is, you know, I know one of your missions in the Spice Canine Fund is that you're building a kennel and all that to have them live out their lives in retirement. How is that, you know, important, and that we just don't adopt these military dogs out to, you know, the Mr. Smith and Miss Smith to Johnny.
Right. I think there's a big line between the dog that you can just take out and kind of happy-go-lucky and go to the dog park or go for a walk, and then the dogs that are trained to cause harm to human beings. You know, that's a very serious thing, and you can, you know, I always joke and say, hey, man, you can lose your house with that dog, you know. There are a lot of military guys who see the military dogs, and they're like, hey, man, I want to get one of those, and I'm like, nah, you know, you don't, you think you do, but you really don't. And then a few years ago, that movie, you know, Max came out, and I remember I got to speak to a theater full of people before it started. And I'm like, listen, you guys are going to watch this movie and think this is great, but this dog, these kind of dogs will tear your house apart, and you don't want one, you know, they're not a pet, they're driven. So I think you do have to be kind of a special person to, especially with a younger dog, a military dog, or now, you know, there's tons of contracting dogs, you know, they've kind of put some of the work out to contract companies. And so these dogs come back and they, you know, they need to be with people who understand them for sure. I think, you know, most bomb dogs, most just explosive, straight explosive detection dogs, even if they're a Malinois, they're probably fairly easy for people to adjust with, families, things like that. But the dogs that have been trained to bite people, you know, be really careful about it. And look, most of the time, those dogs when they're ready to retire, when they can no longer be used, the handlers will adopt them. Or in this, like with me, most of the time I spend is with law enforcement. So the law enforcement people will adopt those dogs. But there are dogs, even among the law enforcement dogs, that they can't live in a family environment. You know, they're not just going to move in with the Joneses and hang out and, you know, on the patio. You know, they're the kind of dog that, you know, they want to fight. And, so there needs to be a place for those kind of dogs. And truthfully, you know, it's the third part of our mission, the third tier of our mission. And I still have it in there, but we haven't really had the need that I thought existed initially for that. Most of the time, the police officers adopt them themselves. And if they can't, then, you know, I'll get calls, and I can, you know, there are people who've called me and said, hey, you know, I want to, and I've, you know, of course, you got to vet those people that they understand what they're getting into. And so far, so good. I mean, we've only placed, I think, two or three dogs. But, you know, it's people need to understand that it's not – you might be great. You might be smart. I may have been a decent dog handler, but I still got scars, that, you know, from bites that went to my bone where I messed up and got what I had coming. So think about that when you're thinking about having one of those come stay in your house for a while.
Yeah, I think you guys, I've seen on social media, you have a term, the hair missile. Is that, that's, I mean,
yeah.
I've always wanted to get in the suit and just let,
oh yeah, yeah.
Let the dog bite my arm or take me down. I don't know why, if it's just a weird kind of thing that I'm wired different, or it's just the fascination of the power of these dogs. Cause I see them on videos and things like that.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you, the hair missile, that's what we call them overseas. I didn't originate it, although I do have the copyright for it now. But we make stickers and hats and stuff, and people, especially people who are associated with the dogs and the kind of work they do, they understand, you know, why they're a hair missile. But as far as being what you refer to as, you know, wearing the suit, it's called a decoy, or in Europe they call them the helper. I personally love that more than just about anything now, because one, it's sanctioned violence, right?
Right. Yeah. Like
it's violent stuff. And it's awesome. And then two, it's really intimate. You can feel the dog in a way. You know, you should get the suit on, but you'll come back from a day doing that, and you'll have bruises all over you just because they're strong. So it's really cool to be like that tight and intimate with them, and to feel them and feel their breath and see how unbelievably dedicated they are. It's seriously, to me, it's intimate is the best word I can think of.
Yeah. In that weird way. I like it. And when you guys were overseas, did you guys develop like a highlight reel? If you ever had footage of them doing takedowns, I know there's probably some aerial drone footage that you could see, you know, this four-legged creature running towards the hut or the village.
Yeah, there was definitely some predator footage and, you know, some stuff that, you know, guys, we come back from a mission and the guys in the ops center are like, dude, because they could see, you know, and they'd show it. It looked pretty cool. But I never really kept any of that stuff. I did make a memorial video for Spike. But when I was crazy, there were a couple of years that I was really crazy. I kind of deleted everything that I'd ever had. And, I just wanted it. I didn't feel worthy of it, you know? So I don't have it anymore. It's amazing to watch. And, you know, there are, for the people that listen in, you know, there's dog clubs, working dog clubs all over the country. And, sometimes if the police are doing an event, they'll do a demonstration, and that's a really good time to go out and see things. And it's been really cool with some of the stuff that we do. Like last weekend, we did a house, canine house building project, you know, with volunteers, 150 people showed up. And then the cops do a demonstration. It's really cool to see the people understand, you know, how the dogs work, what they're required to do, and how they can be such an asset. You know, it's really cool for people to, these people came out and worked all day and filled a bunch of dog houses, heavy duty. And then they got to sit and watch, you know, what these dogs can do. I recommend it to people. You know, if you're even remotely interested in dogs, it'll change your mind about what you think dogs can do and what they can really do.
Oh yeah. I mean, like you said, they're force multipliers, and for the civilians listening, that means that, you know, that asset on the ground is just, you know, adding to the toolbox of these war fighters. And so one of the things you mentioned is you're working with the police, and so let's get a little bit to the vest that you are fundraising and all that. I've seen a lot of people get behind the cause, and they're like, hey, I'm gonna raise it for my own hometown, I'm gonna raise it for maybe my brother that's a canine unit guy, or my sister that runs canines at the airport and what have you. How did you find the right vest, and two, what goes into the costs of it, and how does that all work out?
So the vest thing, honestly, was not something I thought was going to be as big as it is. But it just so happened, unfortunately, that, you know, we had a local dog get killed by a, by a guy with a pistol. He was sent to Biden. The guy was a barricaded shooter, and then he came out of the house and he had a gun. He wouldn't drop it. It's a long story, but basically, he sent the dog, and the dog was hit. The dog hit him, and he was shooting the dog. So the guy ended up dying. But I was convinced that it was something that I needed to get behind. The reason that I didn't know that it would be a big deal is because I had never worked in an area where body armor would help a dog. What do I mean by that? Most of the body armor that we give, in fact, all of it that we give to, that our donors give to us to give to the police, those vests are specifically made to take level 2 rounds. So that's pistol rounds. We weren't fighting people overseas with pistols, but we did have a company that made the vests that I used with Spike and my second dog, Toby, and all the other dogs that we used. And it's a canine storm vest. And what they were really a good company. They're Canadian, first of all. Secondly, the family that started it, the guy was a canine officer, and he got injured. He got shot in the face, actually. He's blind in one eye. And so he started making decent harnesses for dogs because he didn't have one ever. And that they just kept evolving. And when I first started working dogs, we'd work together and rig up some different things so that we could jump the dogs and we could fast rope with them in specific ways. And they're just an incredible company. So their stuff is guaranteed for life. I know them personally, and I'm attaching my name, in this case, Spike's name, to what we're giving out, right? I mean, that's important to me. So they sent me basically a test model. And of course, I took it and stabbed it and did all this, make sure it stands up, therapy, does what they say therapy. It does. Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's the only company, as far as I know. I mean, that's probably something I shouldn't say, I guess. I do know for a fact that they have documented saves of dogs being shot while wearing their vests. So that's a history that I feel good about. I know the people who make it. It's a very expensive vest when you compare it to most of the other vests that are out there. But it's custom fit to the individual dog. And that makes a big deal so that the dog can move quickly. It doesn't inhibit his movement. It's not too heavy. For example, the Boston Police Department, when the Boston bombing went on, those dogs up there had the same vests, and they were in those things for 36 hours straight. So dogs can do their whole shift in the vest, which I wasn't aware of. And truthfully, a lot of the police departments aren't aware of it either. Most officers have a donated vest that they throw in the trunk of their car and they never put on their dog because it's too heavy. It doesn't fit them. It's got cheap Fastex buckles on it. And they're like, that's gonna do my dog more harm than good because it's gonna slow him down. It's gonna get caught on stuff. So what happens is that those people giving out those cheap vests, they get a lot of press, but the guys don't use them. And I tell you, there's one. We did an interview in Cincinnati with a guy named Officer John Neal, whose dog Jones is an unbelievable dog. He bit the Easter Bunny though, just in case.
Well, I have a little issues with the Easter Bunny, so I think that one was right. Okay.
I think he had it coming too, for sure. But, he was the first officer, thank God, that got on television with me, and he held up the vest that had been donated to him. And he's like, look, I'm grateful that people want to help us out, but this is not something I'm going to use. I'm not going to use it because it's too heavy and it's not made to fit my dog. So I think what's happened is that the people who they mean well. They don't really understand what they're doing. Hey, we need a big bunch of vests, really cheap, because people are donating, and then we can give them out to a lot of people. That's just not the best way to go about it, because it gives the wrong impression. Now everybody thinks, well, these vests are crap. They don't fit. The dog can't work in them. So we're trying to change that a little bit at a time, and it's hard. It really is hard. There are times when I'm so frustrated because people are like, we don't really want them. So fortunately, we've got to the point now where we don't have to force that on anybody. Some of the bigger cities, they want you to go get things approved to the city council, and I'm just not going to waste my time with that stuff anymore. I'll just donate it directly to the officers, or I'll donate it to the officer's wife, and then the officer can go to his sergeant and say, hey, I'd like to wear this vest. I'd like to put this on my dog, and if he gives him permission, then he's got permission. It's the same as them going out and buying something, for themselves.
There's the military thinking right there, the resupply, working the loopholes, getting it back to the proper channels. Yeah, I hate paperwork. I mean, the paperwork's necessary, but sometimes it's just like, man, I just wanted to get a vest to my local police department.
Yeah.
And so in this time, I know you've spoken to a lot of groups and a lot of people, and you know, you have experienced the loss of dogs within your military career. Have you had that moment where people just come up to you and they're like, yeah, I had a Pomeranian for 15 years and I lost him? And, you know, I know it's silly, but there's almost that bond of therapy between you two.
Yeah, for sure. I get that quite a bit. And you know what? I don't get tired of it. I understand the bond that you have. And I understand too, you know, because truthfully, once I got my stuff sorted out a little bit, I went and bought a puppy and I trained her. And she has all her certifications. She's a PTSD service dog. But honestly, I don't take her place as much anymore because it's just, they're obnoxious. So, you know, I think that the thing that the dogs did for me, and I can't speak for anybody else, but I believe that this is probably true in a lot of other cases, is that it got me out of my head. I needed to take care of something else besides worry about and feel sorry for myself, which I did. And when I was in places where I didn't like crowds, I felt like, okay, I got to protect her. You know what I mean? So I didn't wallow in my own crap when I had her around. I was worried about her. That really helped me. And I think that you can do that with, you know, if she comes around again, I'll grab her. I have a French bulldog. She's this big and she's a pain in the ass, but I love her, right? I got to take care of her, you know?
She's French.
So, right, exactly. So, you know, I do believe that there is a special bond there. And I think too, you know, it's important that we do take care of them. You know, they do stuff for us. I mean, not just the police dogs, but other dogs as well.
Oh yeah. And I totally get the service dog thing. My buddy, a couple of buddies of mine, they've gotten the certification with their service dogs, and I've been out in public with them. And you know, the temptation is like, oh man, you want to like praise them for such a good job of what they're doing, 'cause they're blocking, they're doing their thing. And then you get like, you know, some lady that sees it, and, or even a man, she's like, oh, zub, zub, zub. And I was like, man, don't do the baby talk. Like,
yeah,
don't talk to the human. Don't just talk to the handler. They'll answer any question.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's an unfortunate thing. It's actually kind of dangerous too, because some people don't get it. People just assume that, oh, all dogs love me. Well, that's just not the case. And they get them, you know, one of the worst things that people can do is they grab them by the head and they stick their face like right in their face. And that's what primates do. And we're cool with that. Actually, we're not. If I grabbed that person's face and put my face up to it, they probably wouldn't like it. But
well, dogs, I don't think I would survive if you did that to me.
Well, yeah, we'd headbutt each other for sure. But, I just don't feel like people understand how dogs communicate and how they should be approached. But I think it's a respect thing as well. So, it is unfortunate that sometimes I just stopped taking my dog places with me because it was too overwhelming for me. I actually got more attention with the dog than I did when I'm just walking around by myself. But for a while there, it was really good for me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that, I mean, it serves a place. It gets the veteran or even the person that had the incident happen in their head or whatever, or medical issue, gets them back in the confidence back into the public. And so kind of shifting gears, I know that you were, hey, dogs are barking. I like it. Good.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they're fine. Yeah, Good ambience.
She's lined up on the couch barking at the garbage man, I think.
Yeah, my kids do that, and the dog does that, so we're good. But you know, we're going through, you know, you've served through the global war on terror. You served a good chunk of it, and you know, we invaded Afghanistan, we've invaded Iraq, we went to other places that were hot spots and things like that. But it seems now the focus has gone away from the regular units, so to speak, but more of the special operators. I mean, we're seeing more and more of these guys injured or killed. And I find it hard to talk to people about it. Not the details of what went on or anything, but to get them behind our troops, because, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind because of the, you know, the 24-hour news channel and all that. And to me, it's like, we still have men and women still deployed out over there. You know, the change in the use of special operators and things like that, have you seen that kind of support kind of be put on the back burner, or, you know, how do we reignite that?
I think, honestly, man, when I go out and do stuff, you know, look, I live in an area where, you know, the SEAL teams are. So nobody here really gives a damn about if you're a Navy SEAL or not. It's no big deal. But I do things in Ohio. I go places, you know, help dogs in Kentucky or Indiana or Illinois, whatever. And people genuinely do back you. The thing that I think that's important, and you probably know this better than I do, but, you know, with the media, it's a business, right? So they have to get ratings, and they have to provide content that people will watch, right, or click on. So, I mean, you could do it right now. You could get on your laptop, look up the top searches on Google right now, and I'll bet you you'd be surprised at them. Like, you know, Adele wins the Grammy. You know, like, there's all this stuff, this crazy stuff going on in the world that people don't want to hear about it. Not, you know, I can understand that. I get it. I think the stuff with regard to special operations people, most of the guys, as you know, probably don't, they're not like me. They're not going to come out and say, I did this, I did that, you know, which is, it's frowned upon. And I get it. I leverage that experience to try to help out the dogs and the cops. So that's how I make my excuse for selling out, so to speak. But, you know, most of those guys don't really, they don't need it. Like, they don't need to feel that people appreciate them. They know that their buddies appreciate them and that they've done a good job. And that's really all they're concerned about. I think, you know, you said it earlier, you know, it's the 24-hour news cycle. It's kind of it's an undercurrent, you know, hey, these guys are going out, sending small groups of guys out and doing damage. You know, it's, I'm glad there's not more attention on them, truthfully. And I wish there was actually a little bit less, you know, like recently with the death of one of the naval operators. It bothers me, and it's a problem that I have had since people started getting killed overseas, and units were identified. You know, for this person, in this case, guys, you know, this guy is assigned to this unit, and for his whole career, he's told, "Hey, man, you shut up. You don't talk about that stuff." You know, well, the minute he's dead, somebody's telling somebody that he came from a certain unit, and that at that point his family has never been more vulnerable, right?
Yep.
They just
pops up and they're like,
right, you know. And he came from here, he came from, it scares people, man. It's scary, and it's not fair to the families, you know. I don't think that the people who are the ones who leak that kind of stuff, I don't think they really grasp it, you know. Unfortunately, we've been lucky that it hasn't, you know, caught up with anybody yet, and I pray to God it doesn't. But I think for the most part, people do appreciate it. They just don't get a chance to mix with that. And I think there's also been, and this is just my opinion, there's also been a lot of glorification of stuff. It's unrealistic, kind of lofty, overhyped narrative about it. And so people are interested in it for that reason and not really for the amount of dedication, time and work and all that stuff that goes into that. I mean, truthfully, the finances, you know, like, it's expensive to run those units. I mean, if you just want to think about your tax dollars, you know, that's a significant thing to think about. But that's not what people think about. They think about confirmed kills, which by the way, man, I just never figured that out. How do you do that? Like, you get somebody with a stethoscope in the gunfight, and they're running around with a clipboard, and this guy goes down, and you put the, and you're like, oh, no heartbeat. And who was it? Oh, Jones over there. Yep, he has a confirmed kill. And where's that office in the Pentagon? Like, where's that? Like, that's a book sales, you know, thing, I guess. I just don't know how the hell you do that. Confirmed. Who confirmed it? Who was it that confirmed the kill? And why does it matter? You know what I mean? Like, you and your buddies come home, you know? That's just one of the symptoms of the sickness, I think.
Oh, yeah. And it just, you know, I worked as a journalist back, you know, actually my first day was 9/11. So, I mean, you know, I started getting involved with military affairs, and that's how kind of I fell into liking you guys and supporting you guys. And the thing was that I always thought was the problem was, you know, operational security. And, you know, given the name, information, rank, all that, you know, in due time, I'm like the guy, let's have a cooling off period. I mean, like, Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korea, even, I mean, Vietnam, we had, you know, 2 weeks or even 2 years to process the remains when they came back home. And, And even now, some of the guys are coming back home from those conflicts that, you know, they're finally getting their final resting spots. But it's kind of sad to see, you know, we got to be first, and we got to know exactly where he went to high school, and we got to talk to that gym teacher, and we got to, you know, find out who he dated in middle school. And then, oh, it's so cute, he had an Instagram post back in, you know, 2013 talking about supporting the troops. You know, I don't know, I get a little protective of the veteran community when you know, the media starts making it their own story and not really understanding what you guys all do.
Well, I think, you know, truthfully, I think it's not the media. Again, they're a business, so they're going to do what, you know, they want clicks, they want viewers. So they're going to do and say the things that are going to drive that, right? So, but what's more bothersome to me is the people in DC, the political class, who, for example, recently with that recent death in Yemen, you know, anybody that doesn't think that mission was a success is insulting this person who was killed. What is that? You don't own any of that. You can't take the blood that guy shed and spread it out to make a picture that you want everybody to see things through. It's just not how it works. It's insulting. It's it really bothers me. And that the press, I understand them. It's a business. There are good people out there, of course. But the government officials who have no frickin' skin in the game at all, like, their families aren't going. It's easy to talk tough with other people's kids. You know what I mean? And then when they get hurt or killed, they come back and they make a big deal about it. It's just a nasty little hypocritical thing for me. I struggle mostly with the political class doing it.
Yeah, same here. You know, they bring them on stage, or, you know, they have this little thing, and it's like, where were you, you know, back in the day? But anyway, that's another, you know, podcast episode, and maybe a couple, you know, a few cold ones and a campfire with the dogs around. But talk about a little bit when you guys get injured and when you guys, you know, even killed in action. I know it's a horrible thing that happens, but the thing that I really like about the military and even the different units around the country, regardless of service branch, is no matter what, that family is not going to be alone ever again. I mean, not unless they just completely shut everybody out, but they're always going to be around somebody that's attached to that unit or was with them.
Yeah, I think that's a, you know, I think you could say that's probably true of people who've been through bad disasters together and things like that. You know, I think when you go through some heavy duty things in life, some dramas, you know, I think that you're going to be close to the people that you were with them with, that you were in those dramas with. I think I can't speak for the rest of the military. And I did run into other wounded guys through that, you know, through that little path that I went down, and they were taken care of. But I was really, really well taken care of. And it was, most of it was because of the people that I was close with inserting themselves. And I mean, even during the mental health stuff, you know, actually, especially during the mental health stuff, because that's not, you know, you don't get medals for taking your buddy to the mental hospital. You know what I mean? The same guys that stopped me from bleeding to death the night I got shot, one of them took me to the mental hospital, and the other one came and saw me while I was in there, you know, same dudes, right? So there's no glory in that. That's not pretty, man. That's ugly seeing your buddy, you know, in this position. And I just feel like, you know, you said it earlier. I was kind of their mission to get my stuff together so that I could, you know, help people out and do good things. And truthfully, man, I still get depressed. I still struggle, but I can't, you know, when people save your life, you owe them. You owe them a couple of things. One, you can't disrespect them by doing something that would put them and their families in danger. And two, you got to live your life full, man. You can't waste that effort. And sometimes I do, man. Sometimes I'm lazy and I'm like, wow. Then I kick myself and say, get up, let's go to work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, to kind of wrap this all up, we've covered geopolitical stuff. We've covered dog training. We've covered, you know, different type of force multipliers and shared a few good dog stories here and there. I'm gonna name some dog breeds, and I want to figure out maybe their rank and their military occupation specialty. So
So okay, we can work that out together.
Yeah, we'll work that out. So the first one I had, we went to the pound yesterday to, you know, we were just looking at dogs and all that, but I saw a Doberman there, and I was like, oh man, I got to have that. So a Doberman, what do you think he is going to be?
Doberman's a drill sergeant, man. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Doberman's a drill sergeant. All serious, keeps his composure through all this madness going on around him.
Ears are squared away. I mean, they're high and tight.
Always high and tight.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Cool. I kind of had the same idea. All right. The lab.
Man, the lab is like the infantryman, because the lab is kind of the jack of all trades. Like, they can do whatever you need them to do, and they're happy to do it. Like those, like the Marines and the Army infantry guys that I worked with, that they were like, "Yep, let's do it." I mean, and labs are that way. Hey, well, this is what we're doing. Let's do it.
Right, and then they're not afraid to destroy stuff and just ask for forgiveness later. Huh.
Right, exactly. Yep, right. That's exactly right.
my lab was his name was Buckshot. So that I'll get to the story later after the air. But how about a German Shepherd?
Yeah, I think a German Shepherd is probably high-end MP, a military policeman for sure. Yeah.
Yeah,
and just disciplined and quiet and humble and gets it done.
And paperwork squared away. Like, there's right. No dots, I's, yep. Across T's. All right. Okay. And then how about the Belgian Malinois?
I think Malinois is definitely associated with special operations units, because they're a little bit they're a little bit sideways, and they don't do well in pretty places and with glass around and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think the Malinois is probably best represented by the special operations community for sure.
Yeah, so he's the guy, he's the dog in the dog park. You just look at it, you're like, man, he's probably figured out about 7 or 20 ways to kill me right now.
Yeah. Yep.
And then how about the mutt?
Well, the mutt, I think that's the most beautiful thing. I'm in a house with 4 dogs. I know it's a bit excessive, but,
and I have 2. I love 4 dogs, too.
Okay. I think the mutts can go anywhere, right? Like, I think they're the most versatile, it's just a matter of finding out what their skills are and what makes them happy and want to do more, sometimes that might be, they may be, let me think of a good, like, they could be the mechanic, fixing, making sure everything's running right in the house and keeping things organized. Or they could be the, stand and watch at the gate, ready to pound people, So right. I think they're just the versatile. I think they're the kind of any MOS they could probably fit into. Just got to figure it out.
All right. So we got all these guys. They're probably some officers in the mix of it. But what breed do you think is the general?
Depends on the general. But I think it would probably be a Husky, because those dogs are built for long, running and pulling stuff, and they carry a lot. They carry a load with them, and I feel like they do it pretty well. And the ones that do it for a while, they just kind of garner respect because they're good and they're invested, and they have skin in the game.
I like it. I like it. Well, James, it was a pleasure to talk with you and, share life and just enjoy things about what you are going through and what your mission is. And, I would be remiss to not ask where people can go to find you and the website, and finally the mission that you have for the Spikes Canine.
So Spikes Canine Fund is spikescaninefund.org, and it's spelled SPIKES, the letter K and the number 9 and the word fund, spikescaninefund.org. And some of my stories on the website. And we have a Facebook page with 106,000 people that follow us. So that's another place to find us. We're on Instagram as well. I think we're actually on LinkedIn as well. There's really 2 of us. It's myself and 1 employee, the director of operations. Her name is Emily, and she's incredible. She keeps the wheels on the bus. I want to keep it that way. I pay her about $43,000 a year. I pay myself $300 a month. What does that work out to? I'm not good at the math. That's before taxes. It works out to be like $137 every couple of weeks, which is awesome. But but I think the taxpayers are kind of carrying me anyway, so that's cool. The mission really is three parts. One is to provide equipment to make the dogs more effective at their job and safer, right? And it doesn't necessarily have to be in that order. So sometimes that's training equipment or, you know, for search and rescue dogs, it might be communications equipment. It might be GPS trackers. Those people are largely self-funded, and they're out doing things that are really difficult, looking for people that are lost, you know, people with dementia or children. And they, you know, so anything we can do to help them out, we try to do that. We just bought some special kind of vests made by Canyon Storm for the avalanche dogs in Sun Valley, Idaho. There's three of them. Our donors, you know, are there for us on that kind of stuff. The second thing that we help out with is assistance with medical stuff. And generally speaking, when, like we talked about earlier, when the officers, a police officer or a military dog retires, that generally that handler wants to keep that dog with his family. But when the dog retires, that's when they start, you know, just like us, man. That's when they start needing medical care, right? So
they're getting fed
yeah,
steaks.
Exactly. Right. And so we help out those families. You know, we've helped out a lot of police officers who had dogs that needed, you know, surgery just to continue to live. And we have a veteran, we have a veterinarian on our board now. And so we're trying to figure out exactly what we will cover and what we won't, but we've been pretty good about covering things that'll, you know, that need to be done to keep the dog alive, unless it's to the point where the dog should probably be let go. And we both know that that's a hard thing to say sometimes, you know, hey, I don't want to put the dog through this kind of stuff anymore. You know, that's a tough decision. But so we're in that little, we're in that area a little bit. And we spent actually last year, I think we spent, a little over $13,000 or maybe $14,000 on medical stuff, helping police dogs and retired military dogs. So my board and the people that donate to us, they feel good about that. And I think we owe them, you know. I think that those dogs deserve to have a good life, as good a life as they can have after they're done. And then the last part, obviously, was the kennel. And that's really on the back burner now, because for the money it would cost us to build a kennel and then to pay the power bill and, you know, keep somebody there to watch the dogs 24/7, I think, you know, that's money that we can put right into ballistic vests for dogs that need them right now. And like I said, we've only placed two or three dogs in the last couple of years. So it's not really the necessity that I thought it would be.
Well, cool, man. I mean, it again, it was a pleasure talking with you, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And I want to thank you for all that you're doing and continuing to do, and coming on the Valor Podcast. This is awesome.
Thanks, man. I'm looking forward to putting it on our Facebook page, and people can figure out who I am. It's funny. It's a funny place, Facebook.
Yeah, I have some good stories, but I'll
bet you do.
So thanks for listening to the Valor Podcast. Make sure to like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play or any podcast management app. Visit our website at thevalorpodcast.com. That's thevalorpodcast.com. Finally, find your mission. There are many veteran organizations, nonprofits, and veterans needing your help. I promise you'll make some great friends,